Well, we are in the second week of our deep dive into this parable. This, what we have said, is likely the most well-known and most well-loved parable of Jesus, the parable of the prodigal son. And last week, we really focused in on the younger son, on who the parable is named for, typically, the prodigal son. And we saw this really powerful and important truth, especially great news for those of us who can identify with this younger son, that God is waiting on the front porch for the first sign that you are ready to respond to His grace, that you're ready to return home. And it's not a matter of earning God's acceptance by feeling guilty enough or having the right plan to make things right. It's just that He's a Father that can't wait to welcome those who are lost home into the family. And at the first sign that we're ready to come back, He runs to us. The problem is, we're not all prodigals. Or we haven't been. I guess there's a sense in which we're all prodigals. We were all lost at one point, but for some of us, we haven't been prodigals for quite some time. We've been at home for quite a while. Or we didn't spend a great deal of our lives wasting our lives. We didn't live like the prodigal son did. And so there's this temptation to think, when we hear this parable, it really doesn't have anything to say to me, which is wrong. Because the truth is, not everyone who is lost knows they are lost. And not everyone who is home is quite as home as they think they are. And there's, I don't know of a more dangerous place to be lost and not know, not just spiritually, I mean, physically, you could be lost and not realize you're lost until it's too late. I've experienced that. But spiritually, especially, that's a dangerous place to be. And so we're going to pick up this parable really right where we left off last week in verse 25 and focus in on the older son in the story. Next week, we'll come back and we'll look at the parable as a whole again through the eyes of the father. But this week, we're going to take a look at it through the eyes of the older son. And so Luke 15 is where we'll be, beginning at verse 25. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound." The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I have been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." "My son," the father said, "you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. So meanwhile, the older son was in the field. While his brother was still walking down the road and his father was running out to meet him and throwing a party to celebrate his return, the older brother was out in the field. And we learned something very quickly, very early on, because other than him being mentioned that there was a man who had two sons, we don't really hear anything about him in the first part of the parable. But we learned something very important about him. He's not like his younger brother. He's working hard. There's this huge contrast. The younger brother is out partying hard. The older brother is out working hard. And we all know that there's no question which one of those two is better, right? It's working hard. Now, before you answer that question, we need to ask ourselves another question. Why was he working so hard? What was it that was driving his working so hard? Because the motives for working hard, as we'll see as we get into this, really will determine a lot of times whether what if it's a good thing that you're doing. I mean, there's it's not always a good thing that you work hard. There are bad motivations for working hard. You know, sometimes we work hard because we just don't want anybody to think we're slackers, which is okay. But, you know, if you work hard because it means you won't have to spend time with your spouse, that's a bad motivation for working hard. If you work hard so that you can, on the to play devil's advocate and flip this, so that you can fuel your own self-indulgence, that's a bad motivation for working hard. The reality is why we do something is often just as important or almost as important as what we do. Motives matter. In fact, our motivation for doing something, regardless of how good that thing in and of itself is, because nobody would argue that working hard is, well, some might argue this, but those are people who don't work hard. Nobody would argue that working hard is not a good quality to have. But our motivation for doing things often determines whether the thing that we are doing is actually a good thing or whether we're doing it for the right reasons. And so we know that the older brother is likely he's a hard worker. What we don't know yet is what drives that. He was out in the field, and when he comes home, he hears a party going on at the house. He hears music and dancing, and so he calls one of the servants over to find out what's going on, which is kind of an interesting little tidbit, because we don't know how long he's been out in the field. We don't know how many hours this has been, but we can kind of put together at least that the party's been going on for a while. And the reason we know that is because if parties function anything like parties today, nobody starts the party dancing. If you've ever been to a wedding reception, of course, Nazarenes, we don't know anything about this. If you've ever been to a wedding reception and the DJ says, okay, everybody on the dance floor, let's get our groove on, nobody moves. There has to be that one person that, and you can see it, you know, the comedians talk about this all the time. You can see the first person who gets captured by the music. So the parties never start with dancing. You have to work your way to that point in the party. So we can assume that the party's been hopping for a little while. So the older brother comes back home and he can already hear what's going on. The band is going, the celebration is on, which means also they started the party without him. He doesn't even know that there's a party going on, let alone what the party's about or anything, which also means likely that the news hasn't reached him about what's happened with his brother. Does that mean that his father didn't even bother to try to find him and tell him what was going on? Has he been gone so long that he has no idea what's going on back at the house? He's been so busy working out in the field, he's not aware of what's going on? Or is it because his dad knows, honestly, if I have to wait for my older son to get home, the party's never going to start? Jesus is telling us a little bit about this relationship here, without really telling us the details of the relationship. So we don't really know what exactly was going on, but we do get the sense that there is something not quite right in the house, at least from the perspective of the sons. There's a distance, and I think we can see it in the fact that when he comes back, he doesn't even bother to go to the house to find out what's going on, which would have been the easiest thing in the world to do. Oh, something's happening at the house. I should probably pop in and find out what it is. He calls one of the servants over to find out what's going on. For some reason, he wouldn't go in. There's a distance here. you have the older brother who's been working so hard for his father, close to home, and yet there's clearly some disconnect. There's some kind of distance here. And verse 27 tells us that the servant tells him exactly what's going on. He says, your brother's home and your dad's throwing a party to celebrate. And it's interesting to me that everyone else other than the older brother is excited about this. All of the servants are involved. This is good news. Your brother's home. We didn't know where he was or what he was doing. We didn't know if he was okay. He could have been dead in a ditch for all we knew. Your parents ever tell you that when you came home late? You could have been dead in a ditch for all we knew, which, you know, happens so often that is such a logical fear that you would end up in a ditch dead. But he's home now. He's safe and sound. This is great news. Everyone's celebrating except for the older brother. Verse 28 tells us he became angry and refused to go in. Now, what was he angry about? Was he angry that his brother had gone and done this to the family? Which makes sense. And probably that there's, yes, he was angry about this. But it doesn't say that he was angry. It says he became angry. We get the sense that this is a new emotion that's welled up inside of him. Maybe something that's been boiling beneath, but it's something new. Who was he angry at? He was angry with his dad. He was angry that... this is probably not something that's directed specifically at his brother. I would guess at this point he couldn't care less about his brother. His brother was dead to him. He's angry with his father. He's angry that his dad has actually welcomed his brother home, and on top of that, he's throwing this big party for him. He's angry with his father. And he wouldn't go in. So what does the father do? His father went out to him. Now, if you have a Bible or if you have your phone or something that you can highlight or circle, I would love for you to circle those two words, went out, because they're really important words and you can easily overlook them, but they might be two of the most important words, at least in this part of the parable. There have been two parables so far. We've got the lost sheep, the lost coin. And those two have very similar elements. One is that something valuable has gotten lost. The second is that somebody went looking for those things. There's a man who had 100 sheep. One goes missing. He leaves the 99 to go find the one. He goes out to find the one. There's a lady who has 10 coins. She loses one, so she turns the house upside down to find that one coin. She goes looking for that coin. And now we have a lost son. And it makes sense. We automatically think, oh yeah, it's the younger son. He's the lost one. But notice, it's not until he sees the younger son that he goes out to get him. Why, and we're going to get back to this next week, but I want you to file this away in your brain. Why didn't the father go out looking for the lost son? We do have a father who goes out looking for the lost son. He is not the prodigal. He went out looking for the older son. Don't miss that. It's easy for us to see that the prodigal is lost. In fact, the parable sets itself up to make it obvious that the younger son is a lost son. But what's harder to see is that his older brother is just as lost as he is. And the reality is sometimes the hardest people to find are the ones who don't know that they're lost, the ones who don't know that they need to be found. The hardest people to help are the ones who don't think or know they need help. But the old, what Jesus is saying here is that the older brother is lost too. He's been living at a distance from his father. Maybe not geographically. It's a little harder to recognize. And it's motivated by very different things than the younger brother's lostness. The younger brother was driven by self-indulgence, but what is driving the older brother? Jesus says that his dad went out and pleaded with him to come in. But he answered his father, "Look, all of these years I have been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders." That's a loaded response. The word that he uses there, "look," is literally, it's "behold." And you know, angels and Jesus use the word "behold" when they're, and so what he doesn't want his dad to miss what he's about to say. He says, "Look, Dad, look at my track record. Look at my performance for you. I have been slaving for you," which is an interesting way to say that. It's not, "I've been serving alongside you in the family business," but no, "I've been working like a slave for you." That's how he sees his relationship with his father. "I have never disobeyed you," which in the Greek is more than just him saying, "I've never disobeyed a command," although that's how it translates. What he's saying is that he says, "I've never even skipped over any. I haven't missed a beat. I haven't missed a box that needs to be checked. I've been careful. I've done everything you wanted. I've been diligent. I've done it perfectly. My track record speaks for itself." And here we really begin to get an idea, and Jesus is kind of pulling back the curtain on what's going on with the older brother. If the younger brother was driven by self-indulgence, the older brother was driven by performance. He says, "Hey, Dad, I performed perfectly for you. And yet you never even gave me a young goat where I could celebrate with my friends. You didn't even give me the lowest part of the food chain to celebrate with my friends." And here's the problem. Those who are driven by self-performance can be just as lost as those who are driven by self-indulgence. But it's harder to see. It's much harder for those to see their lostness. And arguably, it's harder for those around them to see, to help them. And in the second part of this parable, what I would say are red flags, warning signs of older brotheritis. These are signs that we are actually driven by performance. And it's causing distance in our relationship with God that we don't necessarily notice. First, notice again what the older brother says. He says, "Dad, you've never even given me a young goat. Look at my track record. I've been slaving for you, checking off all the boxes, and I never missed a beat, but you never even gave me a young goat. But this other son of yours, look at his track record. It's awful. It's terrible. But you gave him this feast. Where's mine? Where's my party?" It's very clear he feels a sense of entitlement. He feels it's owed to him because of his performance. It's that entitlement, it's that sense that we are owed, that's the first red flag that we are trusting in our performance. So red flag number one is a sense that God owes me. But there's another danger that goes along with that. And it's interesting how all of these kind of, you can have these dangers independently, but they do tend for one to lead right into the next one. He says, "You never even gave me a young goat so I could celebrate. But when this son of yours that squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you killed the fattened calf for him." You hear the resentment in that? This son of yours, he squandered it all. Look at his performance. He wasted your money. I've been making you more. I've been investing. I've been increasing your wealth. He's been burning through it. He's been hanging around with prostitutes. Not me, Dad. I've been hanging around with respectable people. As much humiliation as he's brought in the family, I've worked hard to get that fixed. He's the one who has squandered all of this, not me. This son of yours, when he comes home, you do this for him. And that's red flag number two. We become resentful. And it's always interesting when we have a sense of entitlement and we aren't given what we feel we're owed, it's hardly ever seen as our own doing. It's hardly ever something that we own that, oh, here's why I didn't get this. It's always someone else's fault. And we end up resenting them or the one who's supposed to give us what we owed or the one who gets what we think we're owed. We end up resenting them for not delivering on what we felt we were entitled to. This is especially dangerous in the church, and it's very subtle. You serve faithfully. You check off all the boxes. You've been to all the small groups. You served at all the potlucks and dinners. Where's your recognition? Where's your props? Why didn't you get asked to serve on the church board? You can see how easy that, and Satan loves to use that. He loves to get us looking at what we think we should have gotten. It doesn't ever start out as resentment, but if we're not careful, we can end up being just as resentful and lost as we see the older brother here. And what that leads to, and this is an additional problem to this, connected to resentment, and I think the older brother, maybe this is what causes him to lash out. This is something that he feels. Is that when we feel this resentment, we also begin to feel fear. Red flag number three is we begin to feel fear that maybe God isn't keeping score like we do. That's not an unfounded fear. He's not keeping score like we do. But it's a sure sign that we are performing. We think, I'm doing all these things. I've got the scorecard. I'm checking off all the boxes, and I expected this result, and it didn't happen. So what am I getting wrong? Am I using the wrong scorecard? We look at somebody over here who looks like they're getting what we thought we should be getting. They haven't performed as well as we have. They don't look like they're working nearly as hard as we are. And we begin to resent them for what God is blessing them with, and in turn, we resent God for giving them what we think we were owed. And we compare ourselves in this frantic attempt to figure out what it is that we're missing, what else do I need to do to get this moving in my favor? And the father has a powerful response to his son here. His son's clearly frustrated. He's resentful. He's frantic. He doesn't understand why this is happening. Here's my scorecard. I did all of these things, but I haven't gotten anything from you that I thought I should have gotten. And he's resentful that his brother seems to be getting all of the breaks. And his dad says, "Son, you are always with me." Now notice, he says almost the exact same thing to the older brother that he says to the younger brother. It sounds very different, but they're both sons. Son. The first brother didn't even think he didn't even expect to ever hear that word again unless it was in reference to his brother. He has the same response. You're my son. You're always with me. That's what he leads with. And again, there's no performance here. And you have, it's almost exact. Now, I can't imagine the older brother had rehearsed his speech the same way the younger brother did, but I bet this was something, this came from a very deep place within him. He might not have rehearsed it in the same way, but it was, I mean, he may have even spoken more from his heart than his younger brother did. And the father looks at him and he says, "Son, you're my son. You are always with me. You're focused on performance? You want to know what scorecard I'm using? Relationship. That's you. You are always with me. That's what's important to me, son." And while that's important to the father, we clearly have this sense that, yeah, this son may have stayed at home, but he wasn't really at home. There's a distance, but that's what's important to his father. It's the relationship. He says, "You are always with me and everything I have is yours," which is not just a nice sentiment. It really was. Everything that the younger brother didn't get when they divided essentially belongs to him. He got everything that his younger brother didn't get. And the father is saying to him, "Son, more important to me than anything is that I want you to know that you belong with me. Besides, everything I have is already, you could have had a goat anytime you wanted. You could have asked for the fattened calf. You could have had your friends over. I would have loved to party with you. But you chose not to. Not because you didn't have access to the resources, but because you chose not to." And not only that, he chose not to because he couldn't celebrate. And that's the fourth red flag, the inability to celebrate. Let me unpack that a little bit. Performance-driven people never know when they cross the finish line. They never know when they've done enough. They never know when it's safe to start the celebration because they're using a scorecard and a scoring system that really doesn't exist. They've got all of these things in their mind that they need to accomplish and do before they can join in the celebration. They always feel like they have to do more. The father, on the other hand, says, "Son, I know you've been working hard. But we had to celebrate. Couldn't be helped. You know, this brother of yours was dead, and now he's alive. He is back. He's back home, safe and sound." And notice that he's very specific with his language. The older brother he wouldn't even refer to his brother as his brother. This son of yours, he was already dead to him. But the father looks at him and goes, this brother of yours, he was dead. We've got him back. It would have been unacceptable in the eyes of the father to not celebrate that. We had to celebrate. I love that. Because in that is a sense that he's telling his other son, you should be celebrating this too. Because the relational aspect here is not just important between the father and the son, it's important for the father to have his sons in relationship with each other. But he didn't want to celebrate. And there's a part of me that understands that exactly. He is witnessing something and seeing something that he has no frame of reference for. Grace. He's seeing grace poured out on his younger brother, who he doesn't think deserves it, And he can't deal with it. He hates it. Performance-driven people don't like grace because it calls into question the entire the real value of their performance and their scorekeeping. If God is going to pour out grace and love somebody that hasn't performed, at least not as well as I think they have, then what happens to my track record? What happens to my performance? Does it not matter? Does it not accomplish what I thought it was accomplishing? Performance-oriented people tend to think that our performance is what earns our acceptance and our love and pleasure, the pleasure of God. And when we see grace being poured out on people that we don't think deserve it, or maybe who haven't accomplished as much as we thought they should, we can't deal with it. Maybe we haven't experienced what we thought we had. Maybe we weren't as good as we thought we were. And so rather than going back and finding out what grace is actually about, we just dig our hole deeper and deeper. Maybe we need to perform even better. Maybe that's what I need to do to feel God's love. We just have to perform a little more. We don't like grace because of that, we don't get it. We don't understand it. We can't experience it. And that's the older brother's problem here. If I celebrate his homecoming, I'm giving him grace, and I can't do that. That's the fifth red flag, the inability to give grace. Because if we join God in giving grace, we're saying two things. Number one, we're admitting that our performance isn't really what counts. And if our performance isn't what counts, number two, we're saying, I guess I need grace just as I need grace too. And that's hard for the older brother to stomach. He needs grace just as much as the younger brother. Grace is as necessary for the performer as it is for the prodigal. And what Jesus is saying here is that God is far more interested in your relationship, than he is merely in our performance for him. Now, I've said this, but I'm going to make this disclaimer again. Does what we do matter? You bet. But if that was all that mattered, then the Pharisees would not have had to hear these three parables. Because if there was a group of people who did the right things, it was the Pharisees. They had a deeper issue that many people still have today. There are a whole lot of people who have a severe case of older brotheritis. And Jesus is saying to anyone with ears to hear, listen, my Father is far more interested in your relationship with him than in your performance for him. Now that statement, I know, because I feel it too. You're bristling a little at that, aren't you? It feels like something is missing. It feels reckless. Then what about the performance? Well, just like we saw last week, the reality is, while yes, what we do is important, we can't ever perform well enough to be accepted by God. That younger son, he had a great plan. He's going to make it right. He's guilty, fell guilty for what he did. Still wasn't going to be good enough. I think he even knew that. So what can we do? Well, we can live in a deep, intimate relationship with God. It's the relationship that drives the transformation in our lives and drives sin out of our lives. It's relationship that drives transformation, and our performance comes out of that. The love of God will transform us in a way that performance can never even get close to. Will you do certain things if you are in a true, deep, intimate relationship with Jesus? Yes. But you merely doing those things is not what builds the relationship. It's the relationship that builds what we do. There's this whole, what appears to be a disagreement between Paul and James in the New Testament. Paul makes the statement, we're saved by grace and not by works, which is true. James says, well, I'll show you that I'm saved by what I do. Seems like they're disagreeing there, doesn't it? Well, what James is saying is, if you're truly saved, yes. If you truly have been transformed by the grace of God, your life will show evidence of that. Paul is saying, you just doing those things is not going to generate the evidence. The evidence is going to come because of what God has done in you. But there's still a part of us, though, that goes, well, how am I going to know what the score is? How am I going to know that I'm good enough? Important. That might be the only time you hear me use that word in the sermon. And what ends up happening is that not only do we hold ourselves to some standard that we can never get to the end of, but we also hold others to that standard. And what we end up doing is comparing ourselves to the wrong thing. Our standard that we are called to live up to is not your brother and sister. Because I'm going to guarantee one of you is not going to live up to the other's expectations. Now, are we called to hold each other and lift each other up? Yes. We've talked about this enough. The image that we're after is Jesus. And we only get there by grace. But when we refuse to do that, we don't give grace. We have expectations. You need to perform up to this level or I'm not going to love you. That's either saying that to somebody else or maybe we're saying that to ourselves in the mirror. Or I need to perform up to this level or God's not going to love me. But that's not the way grace works. You get grace. You get grace whether you're the one who's been working in the field so hard. You get grace if you're the one that's been out squandering his father's wealth with prostitutes. God is far more interested in our relationship with him than our performance for him. So three questions, very similar to what we closed with last week. Last week we asked the question of how much of the younger brother do you see in yourself? Let's flip that this week. How much of the older brother do I see in myself? How much older brother-itis do I have? And if you're wondering how you measure that, here's the second question. What signs of performance dependence are most evident in my life? Well, we gave you five. There's the sense that God owes me. There's resentment when I don't get what I'm owed. There's a fear that maybe I'm working off the wrong scorecard. I need to change the scorecard if I really want God to bless and love me. There's the inability to celebrate and the inability to give grace. And I can tell you that even though I had a major younger son phase in my life, I am as prone to older brother-itis as anyone else. At any given moment in my life, I struggle probably to some degree with one of these symptoms or more. I have moments where I see somebody who I don't think has done. I don't think they've put in the time that I've put in. Why is the district calling them to do that? Why? Yeah, I was the younger son, but that was years ago. I've been home working hard all this time, you know. What about you? which of these symptoms are the most evident, and what do we do about it? The third question I'm going to give you is a simple question that I believe it's one of the most powerful things. This is going to sound very familiar to you. It's one of the most powerful things that we can begin to do to cure ourselves of older brotheritis, because it's not going to happen in one big. To cure yourself of this performance dependence, to set yourself free from the idea that you have to perform for God to accept and love you, what is one step that I can take this week to begin giving grace? And I know that's the last of the symptoms. I know that really, when you hit the inability to give grace, something majorly wrong has gone on in your life. It begins with thinking that we're entitled, and as we allow that to fester and we allow resentment to build up, and as we allow it, it ultimately ends up in the fact that we just become sour people who have no ability to celebrate, and we just can't give grace. Maybe the first step to becoming or to being able to give grace is that you realize God doesn't owe me anything. I am who I am by the grace of God. My brothers and sisters are who they are by the very same grace. When you start getting that in place, then all of the other things start lining up. But what's one step that I can take this week? Or to put it another way, what's my next right step? I wish I could do an imitation of him so you could hear it. I should just have him record it and I'll just play it for you. It feels like it carries more weight with his voice. But here's the thing. When we begin to give grace to others, when we take the person that we are so upset with in our lives, we are so frustrated because they're not performing to the height that we think they should, and we resolve by the grace of God in our own lives, that's an important first element. The grace of God in our own lives, to join it with God in giving that same grace to them, then we begin to realize where grace and peace and love are truly found. They're found in the loving embrace of our Heavenly Father. The loving embrace that went out and grabbed the younger son when he was coming down the road. The embrace that went out looking for his other son who had been home the whole time, but not really home. If we can give grace to others, if we can start receiving grace ourselves, then we can see and know where they truly come from. They're found in the loving embrace of our Heavenly Father, whether we are the younger brother or the older brother. Grace is what brought the younger brother back into the fold. And grace, if he had only been able to see it, is what had been holding the brother, the older brother, home the entire time. It wasn't his performance. It was grace. And it's grace that ultimately is what transforms us. We're already loved. We're already held. I grew up. And I don't say this as a slight to any of the wonderful people I grew up among. I don't at all. And probably this is more me telling myself this. It never felt that I was loved or held. It always felt like, man, I just got to do more. If I got to do this. I got to do this. Man, had I at a younger age really caught on to the reality that I was already loved and held? Would I have wanted to perform? You bet, but it would have been from a very, very different place. You are already loved. You are already held. Let that be the source of our hope and peace, as well as the source of what we do. When we can begin to accept that, that we can begin to show that same grace to others. Who is one person in your life that you struggle to give grace to? And if you can't identify it, I can tell you who it is. It's you. Sometimes we have a hard time giving grace to ourselves. Who is one person in your life that you struggle to give grace to? And what is one step this week, maybe today? Maybe I'm giving you too much time today. While we still have it, while it's still called today, what's one step you can take to begin giving grace to that person? Bow your heads with me. Heavenly Father, we thank you for these powerful examples from this parable. And the example of the younger brother, it's obvious, we know, we can see he's lost. Nobody would argue with that. Everybody in the crowd, the Pharisees, would agree that that was the lost one in the story. But the example of the older brother is maybe less obvious and more powerful, especially for those of us who may miss that. Yeah, we've been home, but we haven't really been home. For those of us who need a fresh understanding of what grace is, we need a reminder that we are just as much in need of grace as the one that we look at and we say, well, yeah, obviously they're lost. That it's the same grace that runs down the road to meet the one returning home. It's the same grace that goes and embraces them that holds us. It's the same. It's all grace. And for those of us who work so hard, our Christian life is nothing. We're just stressed out all the time because it feels like we don't necessarily want to stop working, you know, we don't necessarily want to work any less hard, but maybe we need a reminder that all of this hard work we're doing, you're not going to love us anymore. We're already loved. We belong with you. You come out to find us. Everything you have is ours already. May that transform not only what we do, but why we do what we do. It's such a freeing realization to know that we work from a place of already being loved. We don't have to get you to love us. We don't have to be like the prophets of Baal, yelling and screaming and cutting ourselves for you to get to pay to have you pay attention to us. I love how Elijah just steps forward and he says, "Lord, show them that you are the one true God. No pomp. No show. He knew you heard him. He knew he was in your hands. He knew you loved him. He knew he was held by you. May we work hard, yes. But may we work hard knowing we're already your sons and daughters. And if we're not, maybe we're still out there wandering. Maybe we're still out there. Maybe we haven't come home yet. May we know and understand that grace is waiting to embrace us and love us and bring us home. The same grace that holds the brothers and sisters we're going to have when we come back home. And maybe the first step that every single one of us needs to take is this song that we're going to close with. We just need to run to you. The younger brother started his journey home. He finished his journey home. The older brother only came part of the way. But may every single one of us run to the Father. May we experience your love that's there for us. And may that be what transforms us. May that be what fuels who we are and what we do. So that when people look at us, they go, "Hey, I know who your Father is. Tell me more about him." And may we be as eager to welcome home those brothers and sisters who are still maybe trying to find their way as we see the Father in this story. And may you be as gracious with us older brothers as the Father was with this older brother. We love you and we pray these things in your name. Amen.